Welcome to another Shop Talk on the Outrider podcast with me, Jason Quinn Malott, and my associate, Stephen McClurg. Let's get right to it, because I'm doing the quick and dirty intro today because it's the day after my birthday, and I got things to do, man. Now, of course, I could have done this intro other times during the week, but I've been busy trying to get caught up so that I could take a little vacation from work to do some stuff, you know, that I haven't been doing. Finished a novel. Yay. So let's get to it. We do a lot of talk about books and things and a pretty big discussion of Ray Harryhausen and his impact on movies and stuff. So let's get to it. Here's me and Steven with the Shop Talk for October. Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm okay. It's been a rough morning. I was up early and... I've only got about, I can only do a little bit, I can't do much past an hour.
Cool, that's fine. We probably shouldn't anyway.
One of those days?
No, just, you know, maybe better for listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know sometimes I enjoy that helps. I know I enjoy it, but I don't know how much is enjoyed by others.
True. So what's been going on since the last time we talked? Do you want to start with what we're reading?
Sure. Let's see. I'm kind of reading through a lot of short kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Just to kind of thin out the library, like certain things that I've been saying I'm going to read for a long time and just haven't.
Right.
And it'll take me a second to think about that, what that is exactly. But, yesterday Eric had wanted me to read that saga stuff. And
right.
I was able to sit down and read books 1 through 3 of that yesterday.
Oh, cool. What'd you think?
Yeah, it's fine. It's you know.
Yeah, it's fine, you know.
I liked it. I didn't dislike it, but it's just not really my thing very much, you know?
Right.
I liked a lot of the side characters more than the main characters. The heist guy, the cyclopean rider, I
right.
liked him. I liked Ford or whatever his name is, the giant with the huge crusty scrotum.
Right.
I thought he was underused. There are a lot of those weird side characters that I really enjoyed. I've read through... Well, let me see. I guess I could... So have you've read those then?
Yeah. And I've got 4 and 5 on order. I think my favorite... One of my favorite things out of the whole saga was in volume 3 where you have... the writer introduced, and you have that that comment. But no one makes worse first impressions than writers.
Yeah, the panel. I did like that a lot.
So yeah, I've been enjoying it. Of course, I like a lot of the stuff that Brian Vaughn does.
I haven't read anything else. I know Eric liked that. I think it's Why
the Last Man. Yeah, that one's really good.
I think he liked that one. I just haven't read anything by him, so.
Yeah, I think next I need to pick up all the Ex Machina stuff that he did before, or it might have been after Why, I don't remember.
I've heard that title, too, and I just haven't read it. I found a box set of David Sedaris reading at the library, so. That on the car rides to and back from work. So,
yeah.
And that's the only way I can read him anymore, just about, is listening to him read, because it's such a, it's so good.
Right.
Finished some Diderot. I had this book. It was a collection of his works, or just two of his works, and they have French names in the title, so I'll butcher them. But it's like Rameau's Nephew and D'Alembert's Dream, and both were really good. The first one, Diderot's the guy who like came up with the encyclopedia, if anyone's interested, an Enlightenment writer. Yeah, that's his kind of claim to fame. And evidently, like Voltaire, maybe. And I know Voltaire was around the same time as he was, and someone else, Rousseau. And Rousseau was also working on the encyclopedia with him. And evidently, at some point, everyone kind of abandoned him. And so he finished it on his own. I read Rameau's Nephew and was... It's really strange in that you're constantly kind of thrown off guard or thrown off balance as to whose side you're supposed to take or what you're supposed to get from it. You know, like with Candide, you understand that Pangloss is kind of a fool.
Right.
And it's kind of, you have a very obvious fool in Rameau's Nephew, and it's Rameau's Nephew referred to as he or him in the dialogue. But I decided to do some research on it, and it was found in papers after Diderot died, and no one quite knows the context of it, and no one there right. are more theory, like the introduction was longer than the work, chasing down the various possibilities of what Diderot was attempting to do with that. So I felt good that when I read it, I was so kind of thrown off balance, because that's what the work really does. You, no one's quite sure what you're supposed to do with it.
What was the title of the work again?
Often these are fine. You can read all of it online for free. But I've got like a Penguin edition, and it's a Rameau's Nephew, Rameau.
Okay.
And it's often published with D'Alembert's Dream, and I'm not even going to try to spell it and pronounce it.
Right.
I have no French background, so it's...
Don't worry about it. But those I feel were, the same way.
Those were really fun. They were, you know, a throwback to the, you know, Socratic dialogues in a way, but with a little bit more Voltaire influence, you know, meant to be, I guess, kind of just more fun. It's strange. So what I know you have a whole list of stuff you've been.
Well, you know, just a lot of stuff for the podcast, Dreams of the Red Phoenix for by Virginia Pye, and the conversation with her goes up tomorrow. The Lower Quarter by Elise Blackwell, and that goes up on the 12th. My conversation with her, and then of course finally started reading Julio Cortazar's Hopscotch.
You've had that on deck for a while.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying it? I know it's supposed to be kind of strange, right?
Right, and I'm doing the skipping around way of reading it, following the little numbering chart in the introduction that he provides. So, yeah, trying to, because I'm pretty sure that, you know, this numbering thing, it's going to give you a rather linear. In the end, a rather linear way of looking at the story, but you get to hop around in the text, so it's a mechanical disjoining. But I'm sure there's also some temporal, you know, linguistic disjoint going on there as well. But trying to open up the... because I had this idea for doing something where I can manipulate the physical text as well as the story time, the narrative time. And so I want to play around with that. And then, of course, you know, I was standing in front of my bookcase the other day, you know, thinking about all of these projects, and that Hopscotch was getting me partway there, but intellectually, philosophically, ideologically, the image and the language wasn't catching on with anything that I was thinking about. And I happened to pick up Ondaatje's Running in the Family while I was standing there, which I hadn't read in years. And I just popped it open to the first actual chapter called Asia and read this line. What began it all was the bright bone of a dream I could hardly hold on to. And I was like, aha, that's it. This, you know, and the whole chapter is kind of this. It's him describing the way that he finally realized that what he needed to do was go back to Ceylon, back to Sri Lanka, and visit family. And it was all about this, you know, dream that he had on while visiting a friend in Toronto and sleeping on his couch in a snowstorm during a snowstorm.
Was this the character in? Is that?
Well, it's a memoir and it's a memoir combined with poetry and a bit of fiction as well, because yeah, it's okay. He's yeah, making up things like, a bit of his family.
Like, you were describing it, that's why I got kind of confused. Like, wait, what is this?
And so, yeah, I mean it kind of touches. I realized that. You know, I was probably had that somewhere in my subconscious when I was planning my the Palace of Winds, and then the two follow up stories. It was somewhere that was in there. This act of a sort of semi memoir combined with, you know, family mythology. And right now I'm building the mythology, and what I needed, at least once I get into, you know, the story about my dad, is a bit more of the memoir, but also not letting go of that mythology I created with the first book.
And that idea of digging something up too there.
Mm-hmm.
Just more on the surface, since I don't know all the ins and outs of the newest stuff. So,
right.
But just on the surface there, kind of digging something up.
So we'll see how that all ends up going. I'm going to try and get through those and, you know, not pull my hair out and, you know, decide to do, you know, dangerous things in my spare time.
I just read a comic today that I need to send you a link that you might like. It's called On Hiatus by Pete Toms.
Mm-hmm.
He's part of it's a website called Study Group or Study Group 12, something like that. And it's just a group of comics or cartoonists putting stuff up. It's really cool though.
Huh. Great. Yeah. Send it my way. That'd be cool. See what it's about. So you were having a hard time finding a copy of Cinema Paradiso then. Is that right?
Man, we had this, which, you know, it's been available streaming on Netflix forever.
Yeah.
And just a couple months ago we switched because I didn't know we also had Amazon Prime, and we just right now can't afford both. So I canceled Netflix like just a couple months ago.
But Amazon's not streaming.
It's not even streaming it. No, I figured for sure. Like, that's why I was like, yeah, sure. I'll watch it. It's been on my list forever. I've listened to the Morricone score and all that. I was, yeah, sure, I'll watch it. Surely it's streaming, and it's not. I found it on YouTube in Spanish, and my Spanish is just now. If it would have been 13, 15 years ago, my Spanish would have been good enough to just follow right along. But
right.
That Spanish is that is no longer there. So. Yeah, I missed it.
You, You hunting around for a DVD somewhere cheap, or
I don't know. I'll try. You know, I really thought it would be streaming or something, but
yeah.
I mean, most things, like, I'm just now seeing Curb Your Enthusiasm, and you know, everyone's. I remember when it came out and people were telling me I'd like it and everything, and like yeah. usual, was, you know, I didn't really have TV at the time, so it just didn't. It's like, well, whatever. So yeah, 15 years after the fact, I'm finally seeing it, and it's funny. It's really good. I still haven't seen Seinfeld. I've seen parts of episodes and I know about it, of course, but I've never really sat down and watched an episode. So
yeah. And both of those shows, you know, I saw a few episodes here and there, and it never got to me. It never
really
appealed to me. It didn't interest me. It wasn't just was my general response.
That's how I felt with Seinfeld, but Curb Your Enthusiasm really cracks me up. It's, you know, curmudgeonly comedy, and I guess I like that, you know, awkward stuff. Yeah, it just makes me laugh.
I can handle it for a little bit, but I don't know, when awkward comedy gets into the humiliation comedy. You know, kind of what they were. Huh?
There's plenty of that in it. I enjoy it.
I don't know. There's something about it that just bothers me. I tried watching The Last Man on Earth a while back. And the first couple episodes were okay. But then it started, you know, the whole thing seemed about, you know, that just started into this cycle where the main character was. I don't know, for someone like me who's very, very reserved about a lot of things, this kind of desperate need to put himself in humiliating situations makes me so intensely uncomfortable. It's not funny. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, you know, I'm uptight, I guess. I don't know, but, you know, there's probably a gap in my empathy that when I see a character doing that, who's so apparently desperate for human contact and affection or whatever it is that he's desperate for, that he's willing to do things that rationally I would sit there and go, what kind of an idiot are you? Why would you set up fireworks like this and do all this other, why would, you know, So I lost interest, quit watching it, and I paid for a whole season. I haven't downloaded any of the episodes since, like, the fourth one.
Yeah, I would say Curb Your Enthusiasm is a little different than that. It's more of him. I mean, he does get humiliated here and there, but it's more him kind of... He deals out enough that it, you know, it comes back to him in certain ways. And it's funny. I mean, ultimately... The characters, even with they all have flaws. They're still likable, and I enjoy that the show so far. Anyway,
interesting. Yeah. Have you ever seen Roman Holiday?
A long time ago. Long time ago. I don't remember it very well.
Yeah, I've been on an Audrey Hepburn movie kick lately. It was
I watched what's the musical she was in? I watched it fairly recently.
Audrey Hepburn?
Mm-hmm. I think it's based on, I don't know if it was based on Pygmalion or not, or maybe I'm confusing.
Yeah, Fair Lady. Yeah.
My Fair Lady, yeah. I watched that recently. Awkward ending, really awkward ending.
Yeah, that one, I'm not a big fan of the musicals. I might skip that one, but I reactivated my DVD account with Netflix so that I could
get some the best.
Audrey Hepburn movies that aren't streaming.
Well, it's just the best. You have access when you have that to almost anything that's ever been printed on a disc. It really, like, for if you're a film person with not much budget, I just don't have enough budget to manage the DVD thing right now, but it really has just been the best, especially living in Alabama, where that stuff is just, even when there were lots of rental places, you know, I couldn't just go and rent Kurosawa movies or something.
Right.
So yeah, the DVD or Blu-ray aspect of Netflix is just great when you can get that stuff. Have you seen Wait Until Dark?
No, I haven't.
With her? She plays a blind woman.
I have seen that one. Yeah.
That one's good.
Yeah, I have seen that one. It was a while ago.
And Breakfast at Tiffany's, I assume.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I have that on VHS and DVD.
One goes.
Yeah. Oh, you'll be pleased. I did watch that documentary.
Man, yeah, he's I wanted to comment on that. Yeah, he's
I thought it was impressive how many people that have been influenced by him, how they go back and they touch on him all the time, in their own work, little homages and references.
Just the skeletons from the Seven Voyages of Sinbad. Mm-hmm. I mean, those things have made appearances everywhere.
Jason and the Argonauts. Yeah,
is it Jason and the Argonauts? Is that the
one? From what I heard, there was one in Sinbad, and then there was like six of them in Argonauts.
Yeah, it's that group. Yeah, it's that group one where they're all fighting, and they had to film all those. That's just insane. Yeah, I really love that stuff. The ones I've seen, and actually those are the ones I've seen less. I've seen the UFO ones and the monster ones more.
Right.
Those are always the ones that I've spent more time with. But those skeletons that he created, man, they're everywhere. But he basically created in his garage the form for making stop motion animation that was the norm through the 80s, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's crazy. and I just I love these. I think he was a great American artist. I find his, you know, it's he's up there with Jim Henson with me. It's like there were it was like early on
as far as special effects and puppetry, well,
just anything, just things that I was interested in. I mean, I remember, you know, I mean, Jim Henson, I watched The Big Bird, the Carol Spinney documentary on Big Bird, and he comes out as Big Bird and sings at Jim Henson's funeral. He sings, "It Ain't Easy Being Green." I just cried.
Yeah.
Jim Henson. So like Jim Henson, Ray Harryhausen, probably whoever, I can't remember the guy's name, who created Godzilla. That stuff was the first, just out of anything creative that I remember obsessing over and really being in love with. And shortly after that was Empire Strikes Back, Star Wars.
Right.
Right around that time, also Devo and Debbie Harry. Because my mom has always, like right now, like her, you know, playlists and stuff are hipper than mine. She's always top 40. Just whatever's on top, like whatever the popular music is, that's what she listens to. So she loves like Pitbull and whatever. I don't know. She's always telling me about new rappers, hip-hop artists. I don't know what she's talking about. So back then, you know, it was Blondie and it was Devo. So
right.
Yeah, that was just like, that was the first art, entertainment, any of that stuff that I first was just truly in love with. And that has remained, you know, certain things, you know, you get interested in, they kind of leave you. But as far as those go, there's kind of a deep love for it.
Yeah.
I've been watching Godzilla movies for October, and my oldest, you know, she saw me watching the original, and the original is actually really, really good.
Uh-huh.
I thought I had watched it this summer, but I watched the American edit.
Oh, right.
Has Raymond Burr in it, and it's not bad. But I was able to watch the original with all of that excised from it. It's actually a really good movie. It was nominated for basically the Japanese Oscars. And it lost to Seven Samurai.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, that's, I mean, a good loss.
Yeah, absolutely. And the lead actor, the same in both movies.
Oh, wow.
His name's Takashi Shimura. He's the other, if you're a Kurosawa fan, you know, there's Toshiro Mifune, who's like the heavy, you know, he's like the, I don't know, mm-hmm. the De Niro of the Scorsese. You know, he's the lead in a ton of those movies, right?
Right.
The other guy was in over 20, or right around 20 Kurosawa films, and he's the lead in Seven Samurai. So the same year he was the lead in Godzilla, he was the lead in Seven Samurai.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's really good. And my daughter saw me watching it, and she's really into dinosaurs right now. So over the week, we've watched like 3 Godzilla movies, and we've been watching the Hanna-Barbera cartoon from the 70s. And she's in love with it right now, so it's really cool. She said Godzilla is a hero.
Uh-oh. Yeah, no, I was actually surprised at how much Harryhausen did, because I'd heard the name before, but my only real exposure to him had been Clash of the Titans when I was a kid.
Yeah,
of course, I remember seeing that in the theater and just being blown away by it, all the creatures.
When we were kids,
that
was the, you know, that was his last movie, but that was the one that was around, and that was the one that was on TV all the time when we were kids.
Right.
When John Carpenter and those folks were kids, it was all the Sinbad, the Jason and the Argonauts, and then all the monster, the sci-fi monster movies. You know, they got to see all that stuff. The Medusa sequence is still great, I think, in Clash of the Titans. I love the Medusa sequence. It scared me.
Yeah.
So much as a kid, you know, I just, you know, I would think, am I going to turn to stone watching her? Like, what's going to happen, you know? I loved it. Yeah. And yeah, I still like that movie a lot.
I'm going to have to go back and watch Jason and the Argonauts. You know, it's just more out of vanity than anything else.
I've heard they're actually doing a new one of that, but I don't know if it's going through or what. I've heard there was a Knott's movie coming out, but maybe it isn't.
Well, they did a TV movie a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I heard there was a feature film that was going to be done. Who knows?
But yeah, it's always interesting. There've been a lot of different ways that Jason's been portrayed, and I don't particularly like the version that's in the one complete text, Apollonius of Rhodes text. He's a bit he's a bit too
I don't know
what it is,
that one in specifically.
Well, he tends for a hero, he tends to send a lot of other people to do things for him.
Yeah.
But, you know, then again, what are you going to do?
Hold this spear and run over there.
Right. Yeah, not very heroic delegation, you know? Well, anything else you've been seeing lately? Anything new on the horizon?
Well, I've been vacillating between trying to watch pretty good stuff and then art film through a couple of channels, and then there's some great YouTube channels that have really just bad VHS and you know, really bad horror movies and stuff like that. But no, coming up, I'm going to, well, I had sent Eric, I did a bunch of horror film lists and things like that. And Eric had asked to see them again, or like have me resend them. And I had sent them to him, and I just need to make blog posts with them. I think I've done one with the Universal monsters.
Right.
And then he was telling me about this. He was telling me about this horror podcast.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, whatever. I'll listen to it. Sure. And I didn't know it was his. And so even when he posted it, I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I'll listen to it. And I started listening to it, and I was like, oh, that's Eric. I'll have next week will be, I've had 3 weeks in a row of really heavy grading at school, essays, lots of writing assignments. And, you know, my when you're grading writing, it just, your brain kind of, you know, you get fried. And I had no idea that it was his project. I thought he was talking about some horror podcast.
Right.
So I listened to it. It's really good. It's really sharp, and it's quick. It's they're trying to do like 30-minute episodes. And they have a rubric, you know, because they're teachers, so they have a rubric,
right?
That they're rating these horror films by, and I really enjoyed it, and of course I've dragged myself into that because it was, you know, eventual. I would have anyway bullied my way in. But they're picking stuff I wouldn't have picked. So,
oh wow,
that's nice. So the next episode, they're looking at The Visit, Creep. They're looking at found footage films. Visit, The Creep, or The Visit, Creep, and Blair Witch, The Blair Witch Project, the first film. And I will not be able to see The Visit just because I won't be able to make it to a theater. And Creep, I'll watch. I have that available. And then I'll revisit Blair Witch, which is a movie I just never liked. But
yeah.
And I'm not a fan of the way the found footage thing has played out. Going back to Mondo Cane and like some of the early 60s, 70s Italian stuff. They would say films were found footage, but they were always with nice cameras and they didn't have to be shaky and stuff.
Right.
So I'll see. I saw that in the theater. So it's been about 16 years.
Really? That long?
Yeah, it was in the theaters in 99. And, you know, it was compared. I mean, part of it was, you know, it was compared to Jaws and The Exorcist, two of my favorite films when it came out. So, you know, I had really high expectations and didn't enjoy it. So that's what's coming up. I won't be able to see The Visit. And then the episode after that is Crimson Peak, which likely I won't be able to see either.
Right.
So I probably won't talk on that one. Although I love Guillermo del Toro, but I won't be able to talk about that one.
Del Toro. He did Pan's Labyrinth, right?
Yeah, I love that movie. It's probably my favorite movie he's done. And he did the Hellboy movies.
Right.
Kronos, which is really good. He did the first Mimic, he's done the Strain stuff. Oh, another Devil's Backbone, which is really good. Ghost Story.
Okay.
He's a producer on a lot of stuff. He's got a kind of project set up where he produces a director's first film. They have to go through. It's almost like a, not really a foundation, but it's like getting a grant or something.
Right.
I guess they have to send him a kind of treatment or part of a script or something. And mm-hmm. he works through it and he tries to do, I don't know if it's every year or every other year or something like that, but he is pretty big on producing first-time directors films, which is really cool.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about writing a screenplay? I mean, you've been doing a lot of comic scripts, have you?
Yeah, I've written screenplays before. I think I've done two or three full length. None of them. Well, no, I've done more than that. I've done four or five full length. None of them have done anything. And then I have written a short film that's out there. Trying to think. A lot of it, I ended up doing a lot of music for short films and stuff. But yeah, there's one I've written that's out there. And then I think that's it. But I have written four or five full length, like feature.
What's the short film called?
Cup of Joe.
Cup of Joe.
It is a poo comedy, basically. I was asked to write that one, and it was fun.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about writing a screenplay. I've made various stabs at it over the years. But mostly abandoned it pretty quick because, you know, there's always some novel project that I've been working on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I
well, we talked about before. Yeah, you should at least give a shot at Evolution of Shadows, turning that into that or something.
Yeah, I've been thinking more about doing just something original rather than trying to take. Sure. But, there's the big hurdle is, you know, I can either try to write it, you know, and it's always the software and the formatting that hangs me up. I can't just dive in and start doing stuff.
You can do it really easily. Just, is this three tabs or four tabs? I mean, it's not, I let that hang me up for a long time. And then, I just started thinking about how many people I knew who had written screenplays. I was like, come on, you can do this. And it's just a series of tabs, you know, and if you get a decent book that just shows you, you know, look, this is, you know, this tab, this is this tab. And then you go a little further in, it's really easy. And actually there's no, like, as long as you're close to the format, because that's not even a shooting script. So when you write just a screenplay,
right,
that will later get turned into a shooting script by a director and their team. Mm-hmm. And they'll number, you know, scenes and locations and do all that. So it's not that big a deal. It just needs to be readable and close to the format.
Right.
There's no, and some of my favorite folks even ignore, I mean, they write in the, you know, font and they put the dialogue where it's supposed to be, like Guillermo del Toro and David Lynch have no interest in the three act structure and all that kind of thing that you're generally taught in screenwriting classes. They said that most of the time that happens in the editing room anyway, that things get edited down to certain structures, so not to worry about them when you're writing. Yeah, I would look at something, or I may have something here that has just a really easy explanation as far as, like, you know, you tab once here, tab twice, and you're
right,
good.
Right. Well, you know, I have Final Draft, so it's
oh, okay.
Does that might as well use the damn thing, but yeah.
Is that, I just use whatever I have, Pages or whatever the Mac thing is.
Right.
I don't even use special software or anything.
Right. Yeah. I've kind of gotten into the habit of the whole special software thing just because it's an easy one-stop place to accumulate all the research more so than it is the formatting functions of it. Because when I, you know, when I was writing in just like Microsoft Word and whatever, I'd have notebooks all around me, or I'd have, you know, sticky notes when that was a thing on, you know, on operating systems. I'd have other, you know, Word files with stuff scribbled in it. And if I reached a spot where I...
Something that allows you to do the note cards and the notes and all that, like...
Oh, yeah. I
have used that before. A friend of mine, a cinematographer friend who I've written with, uses that, and it's pretty cool.
Well, it allows you to immediately put it out to a finished looking script without having to worry a lot about formatting. In fact, you know, you just select a piece of text and pull down a drop down menu, and you can tell it this is dialogue. This is, you know, stage direction. Mm-hmm. This is blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I'll figure I'd just do that. But yeah, the big thing is that, I use an application called Scrivener for writing the novels, and it allows me to put all of my notes and research and keep track of, you know, locations that I name and use that return back in later chapters so that, you know,
is that a free one or is that a one?
No, it's about $50, $50 somewhere in there. Yeah, and they update pretty regularly. They keep it, I think you can get it through the App Store. Huh?
How long have you used that one?
Probably going on 5 years.
So after Evolution of Shadows. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've just always used, like, whatever the Word, I say Word document, I know that's whatever program, whatever's on the computer.
Right.
But yeah, I've never used any of those, so, except I have, well, like I said, I use the, what is it, the Final, or?
Final Draft, the Final, screenwriting one?
Yeah. I used something like that with Chris once, I don't remember.
Yeah. No, I've tried out different ones. I think when I first started looking for specified, you know, novel writing, you know, applications, I tried Copyright. There's, there's one called Story Mill. There's,
that sounds bad.
Yeah, but it was a pretty simplistic, you know, and it was a good app, but I ended up liking Scrivener best out of all the ones I tried.
Better.
Yeah.
Story Mill.
You know, and the same company that did Story Mill had a screenwriting application called Montage that I tried. And I ended up because of some place that I bought software before, they were doing a special or whatever, and I was able to get a copy of Final Draft at a discount, so.
That's cool. I haven't ventured those ways much.
But yeah, no, it lets me keep track of all my notes and, you know, all that other stuff. So it makes it easier to manage continuity, you know, writing a rough draft, especially as long as I take to write a rough draft.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, didn't you say you finished Palace of Winds?
Oh, Palace of Winds has been done for years.
Oh no! The new one.
Far 19. Yeah, I know. I'm almost finished. I hope I was hoping to be finished with it this weekend, but I've still got a few more, you know, steps to take. But it should be done, you know, next weekend, I think.
Cool. And do you have something? I mean, that's where you could work on the screenplay thing if you wanted to, or do you have something else?
Well, I've got. I don't know what I'm going to do next. You know, I'm gonna put FAR 19 aside for a little while, just get away from it. I'm tired of looking at it, and see what happens to you know, pop through the brain. Because I, you know, I've got a couple of stories that are kind of similar with that feel similar, and so maybe they'll differentiate themselves, or you know, I'll pick one to work on, or I'll just, you know, wander around and just, you know, scribble and see what lights a fire.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, the screenplay might be a nice shorter project.
Maybe.
You know, and I mean, practice, you know, at least like some kind of practice getting the form and working mm-hmm. through it, you know.
True. Very true. Give it a shot.
It might be just fun.
just I could do with some fun.
No, I mean,
I could do with some fun.
A little less pressure than the a novel.
Right, right. Yeah. So what's going on with the graphic novels and the comic books? You and Derek. Yeah,
it just gets weirder. I have to finish some text for him for it's going to be kind of an indie press thing. As far as now, we're just referring to it as Knife Zine. It has a lot of knives in it. And he's described some of the artwork, and it's something that he's going to have with him. He's going to be in New York in November mm-hmm. for one of the some sort of convention there, small press or comics related.
Right.
Since he's already released it, there's going to be this book, this first book of, I don't think it's the first issue, but it's a book of Madballs stuff.
And yeah, I saw you something posted about that.
Yeah, and he's got a cover, and there are variant covers, but inside, from what I understand, inside every variant cover is his cover. So mm-hmm. you can take off the variant cover and turn it around, and it's his cover. So his cover will be with every
cool.
edition of this first one. And I think it's done by Roar, who's a part of IDW. And there's a lot of really good kind of underground cartoonists involved mm-hmm. in it. And because I think most of those folks and me, we always liked Madballs, so we're like, we really want to see it go somewhere.
Right, right.
And I think, I guess this, I don't know if this is the first issue or not. I'm not sure how that's working in terms of what uh-huh. they're designating things, but as long as there's enough interest, Derek and I have another story that's already been okayed. If it goes into multiple issues or whatever, we'll have a story in that. So we're just kind of, he's going up there for that. And while he's up there, he's actually got a lot of meetings scheduled for a variety of projects that many of them involve him doing art, and some involve me possibly writing. So it's nice. It's a group of those. It's likely I'll have some sort of chat book of haiku and American sentences, maybe by the end of the year.
Nice.
Out. So, I'm hoping.
Right. Well, keep me posted and, you know, send me some links to places where people can get them. We can get some people out to buy stuff.
Sure. Yeah. When it's when that one's ready. Right now, the only thing I think is the Ghoulanoids. We have several things on the back burner and, right. and a lot of things that are kind of in process. But some of these offers that are coming up now are kind of preempting some of the other work that we have. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to figure out what we need to do. The knife thing I hope to finish up this week in some way. The haiku manuscript's already done. I've just got to wait and see on
right.
other aspects of that. There's a 30 or so page book that we have to do as well soon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That one's called Eco Ninja. It's a
Eco Ninja.
Yeah, it's in the non-biodegradable apocalypse. It's the full title. It's a kind of a weird take on things like Toxic Avengers and mm-hmm. Captain Planet. Kind of those personalities kind of mixed together in He-Man in a way. so it's those influences, and there's supposed to be an action figure with it of one of the characters.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. That's going to be a neat thing when we're done. I have to get it's more than an outline. Like it's mm-hmm. a semi-fleshed out script for that, and that's what got okayed. And now I have to write the rest of it, and then Derek will eventually have to draw it. And then we have these kind of hostess slash Noid parodies
right.
that we have to do as well. The first one is almost done, and then we have to write the next ones. So we've got that. Someone's interested in doing trades of Ghoulanoids, but that would mean that we'd actually have to get other issues done. When the other issues of Ghoulanoids come out, eventually those will be, and you know, so these individual issues of Ghoulanoids may be collector's items by the time a trade comes out.
Yeah.
What it's been, you know, June was when the first issue came out, and the second issue, I can say, if anything, maybe a page has been drawn. So it's written, but
right,
you know, Derek's got a lot of really good work coming in right now that's, you know, you just can't pass up. So,
right, yeah. So he makes his living as an illustrator then?
He does. Yeah, he does comics. He's in a good spot. He's mostly a stay-at-home dad.
Right.
And the projects he does, they come into, yeah, I mean, he gets paid for what he does, the Adventure Time work and all that. But So he's in a good spot as a creator. Although he has three kids, and so he's also still fighting for time. So
right, yeah. Cool. Yeah. No, the only thing I think I really need to do is more query letters. That's what I should do with my time after I'm done with the manuscript is just concentrate on, you know, submitting the Palace of Winds.
I'm going to be doing something similar in that I'll be submitting and, you know, looking at journals and going through all that process as well.
Right.
Especially while Derek, you know, if Derek gets, I mean, no one in the comics community really knows who I am. So it's not like I'm getting jobs through there. So if I can eventually, that would be nice. But
yeah,
until that happens, and I'm not really, you know, I'm still teaching, so it's just, I've already got more than enough to handle right now. So it's not like, you know, I wouldn't want to do that. It's just, it would be really difficult.
Right.
But yeah, I'm getting ready to start it. When I catch up with, where Derek is, well, I'll likely be doing the same thing, kind of reading journals, submitting, writing, you know, going through the notebooks, finding anything right. that looks decent and trying to get it out there and published.
Right.
Yeah, I'll be doing something similar. Although, luckily for me, most of the journals and things, they're just interested in a bio for query letter. So,
right.
I just send that and I don't have to worry about all that other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been talking with a few about the whole letter thing.
Well, I hope some people can help.
From what?
From the show. I mean, hopefully people that you've interviewed and things can help with that a little.
Yeah, yeah. Mostly stuff, you know, off the record, but
sure. It's just painful. It's a painful thing
well,
to do.
I was speculating the other day that maybe you know, the fact that I'm from Kansas is, well, it was in the random thoughts thing in the that started off on the
I don't think that's
the first Saturday post, is that being from Kansas is hurting my chances. You know, that you know, that some of the New York agents just see that return address and be like, eh. So I'm thinking about moving my yeah, like I said, there's the damn query letter for fiction. You know, you're trying to get an agent to want to invest time in your career by showing them one thing,
mm-hmm.
and not really even the whole one thing, just the first 50
right,
pages,
just part of it. Yeah.
And yeah, so I'm thinking, you know, and then they say stuff like, "Oh, we want the focus to be on the query letter to be on the work," and I think that's not the way that really is going to function for someone like me. So I'm thinking maybe I'm going to, you know, de-emphasize the individual work and focus on the bio. Let's see how that goes.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it's painful.
I'm just trying to find a date online is what it is.
Yeah, I usually, you know, it's a whole other job, and I've talked to this with other writers, you know, the few that I know around here, and you know, you have all these distinct kind of jobs mm-hmm. included in like what a writer is, and you have, you know, here's the job of, you know, reading journals and taking it seriously is like, am I going to fit with what they're offering? And you have right. to do that. I mean, it's, if you're just sending out blind stuff, you're going to get even yeah. more rejection letters than you would otherwise. And that, you know, you're already, you just have to go, okay, I'm going to get a ton of rejections. Everyone does. That's just what,
right.
that's just part of the thing. Now, do I want to waste my time and get a bunch of those and feel really bad about it? Well, you can skip the part about reading what's out there.
Right.
But that's time. So that's, you know, it's a whole other job of doing that.
Right.
You have the job of just writing the rough drafts of the things mm-hmm. you want to do. You have the job of revising and editing
right.
those yeah. things that you want to do. Then you have the job of submitting those things that you want to do. I mean, it's like having, you know,
right.
You know, that one job of writing or whatever, that's bad.
That's just,
you know,
a little fraction of being a writer. You've also got to learn how to market yourself. And that's horrible.
These days. Yeah. It's all that's expected as well. So, it's tough. I don't complain about it too much. I mean, in the sense that, Well, for one thing, right now I have another job. So, I mean, the other job would, you know, is paying for it. But at the same time, it's, you know, if you're committed to you, I guess the thing is, yeah, it sucks, but this is what you have to do. So if you're not willing to do these things, then don't worry about it because there are plenty of people. You know what I mean? Like, if you're not willing to, like, because no one, you know, unless someone can make money off of you, they're not going to go, oh, here's a new Wunderkind that is just, you know, unless they can market it that way and maybe hopefully pull in some money or whatever, you know, otherwise no one, you know, or you've already been famous on a TV show or something, you know, then you can skip some of these steps. Otherwise, if it's the writing itself, like, that's just what it is. Yeah, it sucks, but that's, you know, that's the process.
Should have been a plumber.
No, I've thought about it. I honestly don't know. Generally, when I meet a writer who's never had another job, always suspicious. I'm always suspicious. And then you can kind of look at their writing and go, yeah, I can tell.
Right.
You haven't struggled.
Yeah.
You know, showing the work. Oh, wow, this is all metafiction. Great. you know, to a certain extent, like, there's nothing wrong with that, and it can be really well done, but there's another whole aspect of that where... There can be a shallowness to it.
Right.
And that, you know, other writers are probably going to pick up on to a certain degree. Depending
on maybe
wield.
Right. And, you know, maybe they won't pick up on it because the current economic situation, the current state of letters in America is that, you know, that working class writer, that writer who didn't do, you know, the college creative writing education, who got out of that and didn't have to get a real job, you know, those people are crowding the marketplace right now, and the working class writer is kind of disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the income inequality is so drastic that all you can do is work. If you want to try and be creative and take a flight on that, you've really got to sacrifice a lot.
Yeah.
You know, various securities or, you know, comforts or even, you know, time to sit and do nothing.
It's
which is important for writers to do.
It is.
And people don't believe that. You know,
it's a recharging. It's a you know, that's for me grading, you know, hundreds of papers over the past couple of weeks. You know, that's what Godzilla has been, you know, partially this week and weekend is just a way of, you know, enjoying something and just kind of shutting off to some degree.
Yep. No, you gotta sit and daydream and let the brain settle and clear out its cobwebs and its flush the system a little bit. And yeah, that's you can't really do that if, you know, everything is go, 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 make money.
It's hard to have that space. But, you know, unfortunately, that's just, I mean, and right now, that at least for me, for most people I've talked to, that's just kind of the way it is right now.
And I think it's damaging to the literary environment to squeeze out the working class writer.
Sure. Yeah.
Because then the things that get written about aren't of interest to working class people. And so they stop reading. And then what happens then? It becomes this self, you know, destructive cycle. And the only people reading are the people who write. And that's an insulated, brain sucking, brain devouring
Yeah, it absolutely
environment.
Can. And there's a certain element of that, and then you also don't want the pandering, you know, right. Which is what I feel like a lot of Hollywood, unfortunately, is this mm-hmm. kind of pandering to either, you know, 12-year-olds or, you know, just very the most base ideas, elements.
Right. We're just a couple of steps removed from eventually having, you know, Ow My Balls be the next big hit. I need to get a copy of Idiocracy, man. I need to have that like on repeat.
I need to see that. I've had a lot of friends recommend. I haven't seen it. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. We're going to have to get you that. You need to see that.
I've heard it's creepily accurate, and I don't doubt it.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah. You'll laugh yourself into a weird kind of existential depression. So
awesome. That's kind of what that P. Tom's comic is like. It really is.
That's unfortunate. Oh well. I mean, not unfortunate that the comic and the movie are alike, but it's unfortunate that that's kind of what we're looking for, is this kind of entertainment that will laugh us into a existential depression.
Well, his is more of like it's interesting to see someone take that on and comment about it. Like the fact that entertainment is now directed towards 13-year-olds and just there's a lot in it about the kind of existential dilemmas of the current day, where right. someone is actually thinking about just the situation today, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. It makes it, you know, interesting. I think it's not how I would write about that stuff, but I really enjoy it, and it's nice that someone else is pursuing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's all I got today.
No problem.
Idiocracy kind of just wiped me out there for a minute.
Yeah, I've got to see that. I've had so many people recommend it to me, and I just haven't. Sounds good.
We'll watch Idiocracy and come back next month and chat about it.
Hopefully within a month I can manage it.
Right. I'm gonna hit the stop button. Don't go away.
All right.
All right, so there you have it. Another shop talk with Stephen McClure, the very talented and soon to blow up in the comic book world dude that I know. So be back shortly. Next Monday will be my interview with Elise Blackwell, the author of the newly released book, The Lower Quarter. So I'll see you again on Monday. Bye. If I could fly, how about the world? What's too much living or not? Spill with stupidity. When I see hunger on a homicide, loving brothers, suicide, and on the active breeze who pick a side and hide. The one who's scratching at my door. My lonely paper's got the scores. The human interest stories. And the obituary. Oh yeah, cockroach nets, rattling traps. How many devils can you fit up on a match and carry? Obituary. Oh yeah, create a fire cat. Warm plugs back. How many angels can you fit upon?